Hello everyone, a warm welcome to all of you. Hope you're doing well. Thank you for stopping by. This is Red Ice Radio, and I'm Henrik, your host, as we navigate the dark ocean of uncertainty into 2013 and onwards. Please keep an eye on redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com for much more radio, news, videos, commentary, and insight. Today we are talking with aspiring author Nathan Fraser about the crumbling veil of government and law, how to operate within the system as it is. Nathan is the host of the radio program Live Free FM, where the legal system is discussed, also how to fight back in court and how to achieve true autonomy with one goal in mind, the goal of a free and voluntary society. And there we go. Welcome, Nathan. Welcome, and thank you for coming on the program. First of all, you did a really great interview with Lana a couple of months ago, maybe 6 months ago now, and it's good to have you here on this end on Red Ice Radio. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me on.
You bet. So we are going to talk about how you fight cases today, basically. And I thought here in the beginning, we could just kind of, you could tell us a little bit about what you're going to go into today. You had a little bit of a disclaimer that you wanted to mention of sorts before we get into the main thrust of what we're going to discuss here today. So give us an outline a little bit here and give us your disclaimer, if you will, as well, Nathan.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, I'm not a lawyer and I've never been to any kind of law school. I've studied the law from all different aspects, from the sovereignty approach, from the commercial redemption approach. And now mainly I study it from their own reference materials. And I've been studying law for probably 5 or 6 years now. I have tons of experience in the court. I've probably been into court over 200 times on multiple different cases, myself, my own cases, and other people's cases. And through the things that I've learned and through the things that I've studied and applied, I've been able to get some of my own cases thrown out and a lot of other people's cases thrown out too. So we're going to be talking mainly about my own experiences and my own knowledge that has basically been accumulated in an autodidactic type of fashion.
Definitely. And are there some props you want to give as well here? Some people you've picked up a lot of this stuff from, because there's a lot of voices on this out there right now talking about these kinds of things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for a long time I was running into brick walls, researching a lot of the different quote unquote gurus out there. And it wasn't until I came across and actually had the fortune of meeting Mark Stevens from the No State Project. I met him and was able to spend a weekend with him and picked his brain and learned a lot. And once that weekend was over, my success rate in the courts completely reversed. And I think that he's probably the foremost authority on the stuff that I'm going to be speaking about tonight. So pretty much everything I learned was either from him, or there's another guy on YouTube called Tactical Guy One. And I think between those two, I would say out of everybody that I've ever studied any of their material, those two are the two that I find the most credible.
And that's because you've applied some of their suggestions yourself. Is that right?
Yes. And I do one thing that I wish more people would do that are in this movement is I restrict anything that I repeat to things that I've actually tried. I never read something and repeat it without actually trying it first. So everything that I'm going to talk about tonight, I've tried myself and I've had success with, or I've helped other people with and we've had success with. And nothing that I will talk about tonight is theoretical or me making assumptions. Everything that I talk about comes from firsthand experience.
All right. Sounds very interesting. So yeah, let's just kind of get to it here. Lead us into the topic. And I know that there's a number of points, Nathan, that you want to kind of go through here and the process, if you will. So let's just head on into it.
Yeah, I think really the most important thing to start off with is understanding your enemy. And I think that that's any kind of activity that you engage in or any kind of battle that you engage in. The first and foremost important thing is to understand understand the enemy that you're facing. And in this case, it's going to be the judge and the prosecuting attorney. And in a lot of cases, actually, your defense attorney too could be lumped up into that same category. And a lot of people, when they take on their own case, it's a very intimidating process. And rightly so, because you've got a judge that works for the state, you've got a prosecutor that works for the state, and sometimes you'll have a public defender that also works for the state. So right there, you've got three people all working against you. And a lot of times these people only get paid on a guilty conviction. So they've already got the odds stacked against you. So you're going up against a criminal organization from the very get. And all of the parties there are working against you, the quote unquote defendant. So you need to understand that first and foremost. But to kind of alleviate the pressure of that situation, I also like to remind people that they're going against state or government officials or government employees. And if you know anything about free market versus government employees are usually the bottom of the barrel. If you go to school for 4 to 6 to 8 years and get $80,000 in debt, and you're not the cream of the crop, then you're probably not going to be employed by a private law firm, which means your only options after that are to go work for the state. So the thing that I've learned about most of these judges and most of these prosecuting attorneys is that they're not very intelligent. They may have the education, they may have the paperwork, but they were not the cream of the crop, and that's why they're working for the state.
Well, that's an interesting point. You'd think that they would employ... Well, I guess they have something up their sleeve, though, and they can employ the best when they so see fit, right? But for what type of cases, if we can just kind of clarify that for our audience as well, Nathan, have you been primarily working on? So we have a little bit of a definition on in terms of what you're talking about and what level your experience is at this stage.
The majority of cases that I've taken on for myself and helped other people or gave people the knowledge of how I might approach their case if I was in their situation. The majority of them have been criminal and all victimless crimes. I won't help people or I won't explain my methods to people who actually have a victim in their crime. If they've actually injured somebody, I stay away from cases like that.
Right.
Yeah. But also I've taken on 6 different credit collection cases or credit issuance cases. And on those, I'm 100%. Every single one that we've taken on, we've had those all dismissed. And for criminal cases, it's about 75% dismissal rating, which people say that people like to clown on me and tell me I need to go to law school and I'm not an official lawyer. And the 25% of the time that people that try and use the approach that I advocate don't get their cases thrown out. It's been my experience that even the most high-paid lawyers do not have as many dismissals or at least a high as percentage of dismissal as me and my friends end up getting. So 75% and 100% on credit cases, I think, is nothing to shake a stick at.
Interesting. All right. Well, let's proceed forward here, Nathan, then.
So I think that one thing that I try to implement or try to get across the table is it's really important to understand the rules of procedure and the rules of evidence. I think a lot of people that are studying, and I'm not going to name names, but a lot of the different guys out there that are putting forth material, a lot of people studying them go into court and they've never even looked at the rules of evidence. They never even have looked at the rules of procedure. So they go in there with this idea that they need to cross the bar and say a certain thing, or they need to make sure that they're never referred to as a certain legal title, but they never really understand what's going on in the court. They never understand how the procedure is supposed to take place, what's supposed to happen at arraignment, what's supposed to happen at the trial. So I think the first and foremost thing, if you are interested in taking on your own cases and fighting this beast that is the government, the first thing that you need to do is understand the rules of evidence and the rules of procedure. And so most of what I am going to be talking about tonight is it pretty much all will directly tie back to the rules of evidence and the rules of procedure.
Yeah. Is there, in your opinion, when you've gone through all this, and the more you scrape kind of beneath the surface of this beast, as you say, have you noticed that there is an occult origin to much of how things are being run when it comes to law and the procedure overall?
I think that there's a lot of hand downs from previous organizational structures. So I think that there is definitely a lot of ceremonial stuff that's been handed down, and like the black robes and a lot of the way that the procedures go, and the fact that there's one judge and 12 jurors. I think that there is a lot of occult significance to it.
Yeah.
And I think that that is really, that really infiltrates all aspects of society, though. The past has a way of repeating itself. And a lot of times there's a lot of things that through our entire society, not just the legal system, but through our entire society, you can see remnants of historical significance, but they're really there only for the people that are looking for them. And it's not specifically only tied to the court system. It's in entertainment. It's pretty much everywhere. But yes, there's definitely occult references all over the legal system.
Indeed. Now, so let's talk a little bit more about the rules of evidence and the rules of the procedure and how everything, you know, is supposed to unfold, I guess.
Okay. Well, basically, when you go into court, there's different things that happen at different hearings. So when you first go to court, one thing that I hear a lot is people come to me and they say, well, I went to my court date and there wasn't a police officer there, and I asked him to dismiss and they refused to dismiss. But the problem is it's a very large misconception, and most people don't really address this. The police officer really only has to be there when he's being cross-examined, either on like a motions hearing or your actual hearing or your actual trial. But when you're there for like an arraignment or a pretrial, the officer has no obligation to be there. So just understanding the subtle nuances and differences between each type of hearing is very important. And also understanding what is going to be expected at each hearing that you go into, what they're going to be wanting to accomplish, knowing what they want to accomplish and knowing what they're expecting you to be obligated to do gives you a huge upper hand on tying up what they're trying to get done. And that's usually what my goal is to make it as difficult as possible for them to get a guilty conviction. And if they get a guilty conviction, to know as many rules of evidence and rules of procedure that I can force them to violate in order to get that guilty conviction, so that once I go to appeal, if it goes to appeal, which it hardly ever does, if it has to go to appeal, I've got a long list of rules of evidence and rules of procedure that they violated to get to that point. And then on the appeal, appeal isn't just rehearing everything. Appeal is usually just, these are the rules that they broke in order to get the guilty conviction. If it's found that they did violate these rules, like I'm claiming, the conviction has to be overturned. And if you understand the rules of evidence and the rules of procedure, like we're going to be going over tonight, then it's really easy to, if on the rare chance that they actually do find you guilty and don't dismiss your case, it's really easy to get them to appeal it based on all of the violations of their own rules that they made along the way.
Ultimately, I mean, you are on their turf. You're entering into their arena as it is. But with that in consideration and with the tools that you have at your disposal, when it comes to, you know, the rules and the procedure and everything else, would you say that the system in any way is a fair system? Is there anything within it that you can recognize at this stage? Yeah, it actually is pretty good as long as you know it. Or how would you describe it in that way?
No, I wouldn't say so. I think that the system is basically set up to keep power in the hands of the people that hold the power.
Right.
And I think that it's necessary to have an arbitration system. I think that it's necessary to have third parties that we can go to with disputes. But I believe that all law should basically be based upon consensual human interaction. And that's the only thing that should ever be brought to the attention of a third party arbitrator, is a violation of consensual human interaction. And any system that is funded and based upon violating consensual human interaction like our legal system is. I think it would be foolish to ever think that a system based on violating consensual human interaction could ever provide a safeguard for consensual human interaction.
Yeah. Do you think that there ever could be a system like that that would be fair? I mean, I know your stance, Nathan, as myself as well, have a more anarchist approach to this and hope that, government at all wouldn't get involved, state, if you will. But could there be a system, do you think, that actually could operate in a good way between parties that had disputes?
Yes, absolutely. And I've actually, this is something that I constantly am questioned with. So it's something that I've actually studied a lot. And there are tons of really good ideas out there. But unfortunately, the state has a monopoly on arbitration right now. So yep. None of the other good ideas are even allowed to be explored. And because none of the other ideas are even allowed to be explored, that means that there's probably thousands of other people with even more brilliant ideas that have never even, taken the time to think outside of the box to come up with those ideas because we don't have an open marketplace on it. And so, there's probably thousands, hundreds of thousands of better ways to handle it, but we're not even allowed to think about that right now.
By the way, let me ask you then, the system as you've been studying it, would you say that it's closest to, we're talking about the U.S. jurisdiction here, the U.S. law system, but is there very much similarities with the Commonwealth system, and does it differ a lot, if you even have knowledge about that, in other parts of the world, or is it pretty much basically the same wherever we go?
I would say that most westernized countries, most countries that have had like a British influence are very similar, whether that's Australia, most of Europe, America, and Canada. Most of those areas, pretty much what I'm going to be talking about tonight is pretty consistent through all of those areas. There's slight nuances and variances, which is why you should never just take my opinion for it. You should always go and research your own local quote-unquote jurisdictions.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Where should we begin? Should we talk a little bit about burden of proof, perhaps? What do you think, Nathan?
Yeah. The burden of proof is one of the more important things. A lot of people go into their court case saying, oh, I need to put this in as evidence. I need to have my affidavit in. I need to prove this. I need to prove this. I need to prove that I'm a sovereign citizen. I need to prove that their laws don't apply to me. And I actually go the exact opposite route. For people that don't know, the burden of proof falls on the prosecutor, or the person bringing the claim to the court has the burden of proof. In a criminal proceeding, the burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt. So they have to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And they, in order to do that, they have to prove every single element of the charge against you beyond a reasonable doubt. And some of the elements that I attack are jurisdiction. They have to prove jurisdiction beyond a reasonable doubt. They also have to prove applicability of the law beyond a reasonable doubt, which means that the law actually applies to anybody. So I'm not going to go in there saying your law doesn't apply to me. The approach that I take is, what evidence or facts or witnesses with firsthand knowledge do you rely on to prove that your law applies to me? Because mm-hmm. you have the burden of proof. And another thing that the burden of proof applies to is whether or not I was even within what they call the state or the city or the county or whatever legal fiction that they're using to bring it against me. So the approach that I take goes contrary to what most people recommend or advocate out there. And that's that I don't put anything in as evidence. I never testify. I understand that they're the ones that have to prove everything. I understand that there's a plethora of things that they absolutely cannot prove. And that's what I'm going to go after.
Interesting. I mean, very much of this relies on witnesses, and this one point we'll get to later as well, but that someone else testifies against you or has, information, about you in any way. But is there, as you've been, going through all this stuff, have you noticed that the system itself then has, I don't know how to put it, but loopholes in a way that things are, you can argue, if you will, in a court, that you're basically not, involved in the process as they see it or something like that, that there is something, a way out of it, basically. Is that what you're talking about?
I don't really, if you're talking about like UCC-1 filings or anything like that, I don't really put too much faith into that stuff. When I first started down this path, I used a lot of accepted for values, UCC1 type of stuff. Mm-hmm. That whole straw man argument.
Right.
The Admiralty law stuff. I really tried all of that stuff multiple times, and I kept running into brick walls with it, and I was never able to get any cases, at least criminal cases, ever dismissed on that. After a bunch of times running into a brick wall, I finally gave up on all that stuff. So I won't discourage people from going down that path. For me, I found it to be a rabbit hole, though. So I don't know. But I do know that, like I kind of hinted at earlier, instead of trying to say, you know, your law doesn't apply to me because I'm a natural man, I'm not a corporate person, instead of doing that, what I do and we'll get into throughout the interview is you're making the claim that your law applies to me. So what evidence or what facts or what witnesses do you rely on to prove that? And one thing that you really need to understand, or that the people out there need to understand, is the prosecutor and his legal opinions do not constitute as evidence. And the judge and the judge's opinions do not constitute as evidence. So the judge and the prosecutor, anything that they feel doesn't count as evidence. They have to have actual outside evidence, actual outside facts from themselves to prove their claims. So the judge just saying, well, the law applies, or the prosecutor just saying the law applies, those are elements of the charge that have to be proven, and they can't be proven by the prosecutor's opinion. They have to be proven by facts, evidence, or witness testimony. So, and the prosecutor and the judge do not count as witnesses.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard from various people as well that police, judges, and such have become kind of, well, how should we put it, more savvy to things like the strawman argument, and it's kind of like a battle of both words and interpretation at this stage, and this fight, if you will, actually evolves forward now as more people are trying to kind of both get off the hook, but some of the people involved in the law process know that there are people out there who are trying these different arguments and therefore have found various ways to kind of shut them down. Is this something you've heard as well?
Yeah, I've heard that as an excuse. When I was first getting into it, I was in contact with a lot of the legal gurus, and I would put in their paperwork and it would be shut down, and they would say, well, they found a way around that. What you needed to do was you didn't sign it in the correct color of ink, or you didn't write your name over the postage stamp the correct way, or you didn't word your retort to what the judge said in the specific way, or you didn't say this before you crossed the bar. And there was always a different excuse. I think that, at least in my opinion, the way I see it, the real reason why it wasn't working for me is because the people that were promoting the ideas were just snake oil salesmen. They weren't actually selling anything that actually ever worked. But that's just my opinion. That's from my experience, it seems like that's the most likely reason as to why this stuff isn't working in the courtrooms. I don't think that it's because they found loopholes around it or ways around it. I think that the very foundation of what a lot of these people are promoting is actually flawed.
So tell us about what the differences are between case law and statutory law.
Yeah. First of all, they're both, in my opinion, case law and statutory law are both man-made laws. And man-made law is really just it's an opinion backed up by a gun. It's somebody saying, well, this is what we think should be done, and we've got people that will shoot you if you don't go along with it. So we think on this side of the imaginary line, you can't have this plant. But on this side of the imaginary line, you can have this plant, and we have people that will shoot you based upon that belief. So both statutory and case law fall into that. It's man-made fictional law that doesn't actually apply. In my opinion, the only law that really applies is that human interaction should be on a consensual basis. But statutory law is the law that's codified in statutes and in codes and things like the UCC and things like the Colorado Revised Statutes and things like the all of the different federal laws, everything that you read as far as statutes go, that's statutory law. Case law is the legal findings or case outcomes of previous cases. So case law is usually like precedent setting laws, and a judge can totally choose to ignore previous cited laws, and that sometimes gives you a good chance on appeal. But case law is, it's important to know the difference, because case law is usually used in your motions. A lot of times when people put in motions, or when I put in motions, I cite a lot of case law, but statutory law is used more for what they use. Case law is usually what I use. Statutory law is usually what they use. But both of them are just people's opinions backed up by a gun.
Yeah, unfortunately, that is what it is at the end of the day. When it comes down to the nuts and bolts of how the system operates, it's sad, but it's true. Is there anything more we should say about procedure and how a case progresses, Nathan?
Yeah, before we get into that, though, specifically for case law and the things that I use, case law has a lot to do with the way that I set up my motions, like I said. And one of the things that I attack is corpus delicti. And for people that don't know what corpus delicti is basically the body that proves that there was a crime. A lot of times, like if there was a murder, you needed to have the body. So that was the corpus delicti. But corpus delicti in case law that I use, if you don't mind, I could just read a couple off real quick.
Sure.
It says, the corpus delicti of a crime minimally requires two elements. One, an injury, which is penally prescribed. And two, the unlawfulness of some person's conduct that caused that injury. That's from People of the State of Colorado versus Smith. In every crime or every criminal trial, the prosecution must prove corpus delicti or the body of the crime itself, i.e. the fact of injury, loss, or harm, and the existence of criminal agency as its cause. This is in California. It's traditionally held that prosecution cannot satisfy this burden without relying exclusively upon extrajudicial statements, confessions, and admissions of the defendant. That's from People versus Alvarez. This is from State versus Libero. It says, in order to prove that a crime has occurred, the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there was one, basic injury, and two, the fact that the basic injury was a result of criminal rather than natural or accidental cause. Mm-hmm. So corpus delicti, you've heard the term no victim, no crime. That's the basis of that. Mm-hmm. And so that's one thing that I use the majority of the time. When these people are coming against you, it's for not wearing a seatbelt or not having the correct number on the sticker on your license plate or possessing a plant that they told you that you're not allowed to possess. And none of those have a victim. So by their own case law, they're violating their own rules by coming after you. So I bring that up. And then the other thing that I usually attack is what the jurisdiction relies upon is that I was within their jurisdiction or I was within their state. The problem is a state is a legal fiction. The state of Colorado, where I live at, didn't exist 150 years ago. The land did. So the land and the state are not the same thing. The state is a legal fiction. The state is an idea. The state didn't exist until somebody put some paperwork together and said, now this area of land is going to be known as the state of Colorado. So the state, if the state ceases to exist, the land doesn't cease to exist. So by simply saying I was in a geographic location, that does not prove I was within the state. And legally, a citizen is somebody that lives inside of a state, a member of the state that owes allegiance to the state. I think it was Lauria versus the United States, they said citizenship is a membership in a political society. It implies the reciprocal obligations as compensation for each other of a duty of allegiance on the part of the member and a duty of protection on the part of the society. So a state is obligated to provide you protection. And anybody that understands how our state operates or anybody that has access to YouTube can just watch all the police brutality videos and see that the state is not interested in protecting you. You can look at things like 9/11 where they fail miserably to protect you and nobody's held accountable. And then if you actually Google the search term no duty to protect, you'll find over and over and over that they have ruled that even if they even though that it's horrible when the state fails to protect somebody, there is no duty to protect. So that's a really good search term for people to look up, no duty to protect. And once you realize that a state only exists legally when they're protecting the citizens, and then the people that call themselves a state turn around and say they have no duty to protect you, the whole reciprocal obligation between you and the state completely vanishes. And so legally, there is no state. Reality-wise, factually, the state is just a figment of the imagination. And in order for them to prove they have jurisdiction, one of the elements is to prove my presence within their state. Well, if their state doesn't exist factually and their state doesn't exist legally, then there's no way to prove I was in it. So I've never, ever had them be able to prove my presence within a state or anybody else's presence within a state. And since they can't prove presence within a state, they can't prove jurisdiction, they can't prove applicability of the law. So based off of corpus delicti and presence within the state, those are the two main things that I attack when I go into any kind of criminal proceeding.
Well, that's very interesting. My perception has always been that, you know, kind of just what you say as well, that they, even though that we hear these various claims that the state is, you know, for and, you know, by the citizens, pretty much, they, when it comes down to that, they do as they please anyway. And numerous examples, just as you describe, and there are many, many more, is evident that they are above the law and they do not follow their own procedures that they've set up. But it, within this, there's also a lot of interpretation. And that's really where it comes down to, it seems, that if you can argue with the interpretation of you know, previous cases and everything else, you can find a way out of it. But the problem, I guess, with it is that at the end of the day, Nathan, this is about someone else, with violence, that they are forcefully doing what they want to do, and if you're standing in the way of that, you're unlucky to be in the way of that, right? That's what it comes down to at the end of it.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing about it is, though, once a deity, in my opinion, the state is just a deity. Once the belief in a deity becomes non-beneficial to the people that are ruled by it, the belief in that deity tends to dissipate and disappear. And we've seen this historically throughout time with all previous giant empires and societies, that once the people stopped believing in the deity that ruled their that set up their master class, their ruling class, their priest class, whatever. Once they stopped believing in it, it lost all power over the society. And that didn't mean that the society crumbled and fell apart. It just meant that the people that were in control of the society had to go and find new jobs. And when you're in court and pretty much the whole legal system altogether, they have to walk a delicate balance. They have to get away with their crimes, but at the same time, they have to present a sense of legitimacy to them. And so if you bring up these things and you catch them on their own rules and they just railroad over you, they might have a minor victory over you, the one individual, but if they constantly keep doing this to people over and over and over again, the people stop seeing them as legitimate. And in my opinion, is what we're watching happening in not just the American culture, but pretty much worldwide. People are starting to realize that this belief in this state, this belief in this government concept is not beneficial to humanity. And I think that belief in it is waning. And the more these people, like you said, exert their violence and just bully you around, the more they expose their own illegitimacy, and in the long run, the more damage they do to themselves.
Yeah, more people will speak up against that. As far as you know, Nathan, are there any clear kind of examples or cases where, let's say, a certain behavior then by the state has been, you know, found out and someone has called them on it, and the state has been forced to turn around or stop doing that? It doesn't mean that it, you know, might happen in isolated cases here and there after that fact or that point, but do you know of any that where something has been, you know, a certain behavior has been repeatedly done over and over again, but then at a certain point someone has, you know, challenged, if you will, the state on it and managed to get them to change their behavior or stop doing what they're doing?
Yes, actually, just I think today or yesterday I was reading a story about a judge that is kind of re-establishing the guidelines for the stop and frisk in New York. The stop and frisk procedure in New York has gotten way out of control. They've just been using it as a way to racially target and profile people. They've been using it as a way to do basically fishing expeditions where they'd stop people and try and get them for as much as they can with no probable cause whatsoever. And recently, either today or yesterday, a judge just ruled that they have to stop doing that. But at the same time, I have very little faith that hoping that the state will solve the problems of the state will actually be effective.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that is the problem, isn't it? We're trying to go to the same beast and machine that's created many of these problems in the beginning and asking them to fix it and to solve it. So as you say as well, they are walking a fine line, but so are we, I guess, the people are interested in not being part of the system or trying to not be exploited by it, I guess, where, you know, how much should we operate? But in your view then, Nathan, I guess you're doing this because, again, the threat of the violence, I guess, at the end of the day, we're talking about people who will have their freedom, if you will, to live as they want to live, taken away from them if they do not decide to challenge the claims made against them? Or how would you explain that?
I think that's a perfect explanation. I, at all costs, avoid the court system. And I, like you kind of touched on earlier, I agree it's not very smart to go and battle the beast on the beast's home turf. And with the beast's weapons, you don't walk up to a bully and let him pick where you're going to fight and let him pick what tools are going to be used or what weapons are going to be used.
Yep.
But at the same time, expecting that the bully is going to come after you eventually, it's always good to be prepared and know how to fight on the home turf and know what weapons are usually going to be used. So I don't study this stuff or teach people about this stuff in the expectation of going and picking a fight with the beast, but with the knowledge that the beast is eventually going to come to your door for something stupid. Every day they pass new laws and new excuses to get innocent people in their clutches. And so even if you're not doing anything wrong today, something that you're not doing wrong today might be wrong by them tomorrow, according to them tomorrow.
Yes.
So they might be at your doorstep tomorrow. So don't go looking for a fight. But if a fight comes to you, I think that it's smart to understand the weapons that are going to be used against you.
Before we proceed and talk about the rest of the things here, do you think that, I mean, we've seen this in countries in the past that at a certain point it gets so bad that it doesn't matter that the majority of people speak up against a certain behavior, they're still under the the boot of tyranny, if you will, and people are being subjected to the terror by the state. Fascism, socialism, there's a number of these various isms out there where people are they're forced to live in a certain way, although they don't have to. Is that, and as bad as that is in itself, is it those situations where people have to finally kind of come together and try to fight against the tyranny that they're subjected to? Or are there other modalities, other ways of doing it more quietly, if you will? Because it always seems to be these extremes that, the state pushes more and more and more and more, and eventually the people speaks up more and more and more, and it gets extremely polarized. And then at a certain point in history, you get this violent clash between, the state and those who are, siding with them and the rest of the people. That just seems to be how it always goes around, isn't it?
There's two different ways. And Rome is a really good example of this. When Rome was doing their empire building, if they sent somebody, if they took over a territory and they sent somebody from Rome in there to collect the taxes and preside over the people, they would usually be overthrown and they would lose that territory. But if they hired somebody from that territory to collect the taxes and preside over the people were less likely to resist and less likely to fight back. So there's always that. There's also, history has examples like Britain trying to rule over India. And when it was kind of the similar situation, that it was an outside invading force, and the Indian people made it too costly, basically, for and showed the illegitimacy of the British rule at the time. So it was too expensive, and the veil of legitimacy was too hard to maintain. So they had to withdraw peacefully. The British government did. So there's examples where the oppressors, the tyrants, have withdrawn peacefully. Sadly, though, power achieved or power gained is usually not given up without a fight. No. So sadly, historically, there's many more examples of it having to come to an actual violent altercation. I hope to God that's not where we're going. I do remain hopeful, though, because there are a lot of people that rather than a direct head-on conflict with the state, there are people that are finding alternative ways of battling the state. Agorism and absolute free market anarchism is one way. A lot of people are just refusing to feed the state, refusing to get the regulations, you know, the pieces of paperwork and the permission slips from the state to operate their businesses. They're not paying their taxes. And that's one good way. There's technology that's coming out that help us evade the state or avoid the state. There's technologies like 3D printers. There's technologies like, you know, free education on the internet and entire courses in higher education that are available. There's a lot of stuff right now, disruptive technology that's really shaking the core of the established power structure. And I still think it's a 50-50 direction. I'm not hopeful in a violent revolution, though, because my main objection to the way that the state operates is that it gets what it wants through violence, through aggression, through coercion. And I don't think that fighting a system based on violence and aggression and coercion with violence and aggression and coercion is going to be very effective. So I hope it's my sincere hope that we can avoid a violent conflict and resolve this situation without having to come to a national or a worldwide violent revolution.
Yeah, I agree with that. And then there's a question as well of what is a tyranny, how people would define it, and also how people, in most cases, do not question it. Because, I mean, there is the idea of the cryptocracy, if you will, then that and that's what I feel that the promotion of the democratic system has been, a kind of a false, you know, image given to people that now you are free, you know, that the power group claims that now you are free to choose and vote for who you want to. But then you have a whole nother level to it underneath there where people still are, you know, manipulated by this. Politician takes kickbacks, whatever. There's a number of ways to display this out in our world today where there is a more or less a conspiracy of how to rule people. But many, unfortunately, at this stage, wouldn't agree with that because they haven't questioned enough, am I living under a tyranny, right?
Yeah, and I think that democracy is just basically a softer tyranny. I think that slavery and human farming is what most governments of all forms are. Democracy is the one that's easiest to continue for long periods of time because it allows the people to participate in the tyranny rather than one guy telling you what you can and can't do. Now we all get to tell each other what we can and can't do. Instead of one guy robbing us and taking a percentage of our income, now we all get to participate in robbing each other and taking a percentage of each other's income. So it's a much more effective way of human farming. But regardless, even a democracy is still a form of human farming. And so,
yeah,
thus, I'm against even democracies.
Yeah, yeah. But would you agree, though, that most people, they don't question that, and therefore we're in an increasingly difficult situation of trying to explain? I mean, it's like trying to, you know, explain to a rat in a maze somewhere that, you know, you're trapped. Don't you realize it? You know, while they're just running around in it. And there's there's no way you can kind of reach them, if you will. And that's where the crux of the situation seems to be right now, that if it is a numbers game, and it necessarily it might not be, but if it is, and if it is up to a majority of people, you know, speaking up and you know, actively disengaging with the system that they're trapped in, then it feels like, although maybe it's a growing number, we're still kind of losing that battle, if you will, Nathan.
Yeah, but I do think that you also, anybody listening, needs to keep in mind, they spend a ton of resources, stolen money, and time. It's not our natural order to be ruled. It's completely antithetical to the human nature to have rulers. They have to spend millions of dollars on an education of pure indoctrination. They have to spend trillions of dollars controlling the media and buying tons and tons of weapons in order to ensure it.
Yeah.
And so it's not something that's natural to humanity. It's something that's completely unnatural to us. And they have to spend an exorbitant amount of time and resources to trick us into it. So it's against human nature. And I think that eventually it's like all other control systems in the past that have failed. I think eventually the one that is being exploited right now is also going to fail. I don't know if it'll be within my lifetime, but I do, in my heart of hearts, I do believe that it will eventually fail.
All right. Very good. So let's proceed here. Where do we go next, Nathan, right now?
Do you want to just kind of go through how I actually approached the case, or did you want to save that for the second hour?
No, we can do that right now. I think it's a good spot here before we take a break in about 10 or so. So let's do that. Yeah.
Okay. So like I was saying, understanding the rules of procedure lets you know what's going to happen at each point of your trial. So the very first thing is you're going to go to your arraignment, which means they're going to try and get a plea from you, or you're going to go to pretrial where they're going to try and work out some sort of deal before it has to go to an arraignment or before they have to actually bring the judge in and waste more resources. So the very first thing that I always do, as soon as I get a ticket, or as soon as I get any kind of citation, if not possibly that day, then the very next day, I go straight to the courthouse and I put in a request for discovery. And discovery is basically both parties have to come to the table completely revealing everything that they're going to use. So this idea that a lot of times you see on these court dramas where they have a surprise witness that comes in and completely, you know, the plot twists because of the surprise witness, that's actually not allowed in court. They're not allowed to withhold any kind of evidence or information against you.
Right.
And the way that you find out what evidence is going to be used or what witnesses are going to be used is the process of discovery.
By the way, how long time do they usually let you have on preparing for it?
You know what? I've had cases that went through from beginning to dismissal within a week or two. And then I've also had cases that dragged on for over a year.
Wow.
So
yeah.
There's really no way. It just depends on how much of a grudge the judge is going to hold against you once they realize that you've got their number.
And do you have any say in that as opposed to like, okay, I need more time to prepare for this, or the allegations made against, you know, your client or whatever, how much, you know, can you argue in any regard in terms of the time for that?
They have something called a continuance where one of the rules for their courts that's in the rules of procedure is that anything that goes on, it has to be voluntary and knowingly. So in order for you to enter a plea, in order for you to be on trial in the first place, you have to be competent, you have to know what's going on, and you have to be doing it voluntarily. And so one of the things that I use to my advantage is the fact that I'm not a lawyer. I don't know what's going on. I'm very confused about what's going on. What I read in their rules seems to be contrary to what they're doing. So I can hang them up for months and months and months just by approaching it from the same, asking the same three questions over and over again at arraignment. And I've had my arraignment set back 4 or 5 times just by asking 3 questions. And every single time they say, oh, I'm not going to answer that. I'm going to let you go seek legal advice or legal counsel, and we can come back in 6 weeks. So depending on how long you want it to last, I mean, nowadays I try to get it done and dismissed as quick as possible.
Yeah.
But when I was first getting into it and I was very intimidated by the whole process, I tended to allow them to continue my case as long as possible to try to avoid or delay the inevitable, as some might say.
Interesting. Is there more we can say about discovery and that process?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I put my discovery in, like we were talking about earlier, I know there's certain things that they cannot prove no matter what. And so those are the things that I'm going to go after.
Any example on that? What that would be?
Yeah, absolutely. What I'm go and this is what you need to understand about discovery is that I'll go ahead and read a couple of some more case law. It says that this is People versus Gallegos, and this is from Colorado. It says defense counsel to determine relevance and usefulness of the statement to defense. Generally, defense counsel is the appropriate party to make the determination that the statement is relevant to the conduct of the defense. This one is going to be from People versus Diefenderfer. I probably butchered that name, but this is from Colorado as well. It says, determination of the usefulness of evidence under Part 1E, now Part D, is a defense function, not a prosecutorial function, as only the defense can determine what material will be helpful to its case. Actually, that was from People versus Smith, and then it was expanded in People versus Diefenderfer. The rule governs the obligation of the prosecutor to cooperate with the defendant in securing of evidence. Thus, the prosecutor is obligated to give the names of addresses or and addresses of witnesses, as well as reports, statements, etc., of the experts it intends to use. And then lastly, this rule clearly grants the defense counsel the right to obtain names of witnesses and any statements that they might have, which they might have given prior to preliminary hearing. So over and over in case law, they have ruled that the evidence or the witnesses that are going to be used in the case to prove the points against you, to prove the elements against you, if you ask for them, you're the one who decides. You being the defendant, you get to decide what's important to your case, and they have to provide that information. They cannot withhold whatever elements that you want to know who they're relying to prove on, whatever part of their case you want to know who they rely on to prove it or what facts they rely on to prove it. It's their obligation before you even enter a plea. It's their obligation to give that stuff to you. So when I put in my request for discovery, I know that they have to provide it for me, and I know which things they absolutely cannot provide. So when I put in my discovery, I want to know who the names of every single witness that the prosecution relies on to prove my presence within the state or the city. I want to know who they rely on to prove that I'm a subject to their laws. I want to know who they rely on to prove the corpus delicti, which was the actual injury or the violation of rights that occurred. I want to know what witnesses or experts in the interpretation and the applicability of Colorado law that they rely on to prove that the law applies to me, to prove that the statutes apply to me. I want to know any and all evidence that the ticketing agent at the time of the arrest had that proved to him that I was present within the state of the Colorado, and any evidence that he had at the time of the arrest that proved that I was subject to their laws or that their laws applied to me. And those are things that I know that they cannot prove. There's no way to prove. And like I said, they've ruled in their own case law multiple times that if it's pertinent to the case, and I believe it's pertinent to the case, it must be revealed to me during discovery. And all discovery has to be revealed before I can even enter a plea. So if I go to arraignment and they want to get a plea from me, and they still haven't provided any of the stuff that I've asked for because I know they can't. That's usually a lot of times one of my friends in Boulder, Colorado, just last week or the week before last, had a case thrown out before it was two different charges, driving without a license and driving with expired plates. And both charges were dismissed before he even entered a plea. And this isn't like a random or a rare thing. I've had a lot of cases thrown out before we even entered pleas, just based on the fact that they have to provide discovery and the things that I ask for in discovery, I'm fully entitled to, but there's no way that they can provide.
Interesting. Well, I would kind of want to ask you more about that and what some of those things were. Maybe we can take a clear example of that. But I think we should take a little break here between our segments, Nathan. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your website, of course, and give out people some of the details of where they can, follow you and your work a little bit more closely. So let's do that first.
Yeah, absolutely. I do a radio show. It's called Live Free FM, and it airs every Sunday night on the Truth Frequency Radio Network. And all the archives are available for free over at livefreefm.com or livefree.fm. And the site has, like I said, it has all the archives of the show, but it also has some of my own writings on experiences that we've had in court. I have a book that's available for free there called As King, A Simple Guide to Autonomous Living. And it just kind of goes through how I approach the legal system, a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about so far today, and a little bit more detail. But it's basically my life's work, and everything that I put on Live Free FM is to educate people about freedom and hopefully bring about a free society. So if you want to check out, if you're interested, if this conversation has been appealing to you, go over to the website, Live Free FM, and check out more.
Very good, Nathan. Again, livefreefm.com. We'll have the link up on redicecreations.com. We're going to continue talking more about this. Of course, I find this very, very interesting and, of course, useful as well. So we'll take a short break. Stay with us, everyone. We'll be right back with more.